This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. We think of the New Deal in historical terms, a monument of federal action almost universally understood to have rescued America from the Great Depression. What the textbooks seldom dwell on is the national politics of the day, pitting the supporters of FDR against Wall Street, big business, conservatives, far-right religious figures, naked anti-Semites, and those generally wary of creeping socialism as a prelude to communist totalitarianism. And it got ugly in very familiar ways. Kim Phillips Fine is a historian at NYU and author of Invisible Hands, The Businessman's Crusade Against the New Deal. Kim, welcome to OTM.
Thanks for having me.
As you look back at the contemporaneous arguments against
right.
the deal, you have isolated two main themes. What were those two basic accusations about what the New Deal would wreak upon our society?
So one line of argument against various parts of the New Deal is that it represented a step towards totalitarianism and dictatorship, that Roosevelt was setting himself up as a tyrant and was going to trounce the Constitution and was going to nationalize property and was going to end capitalism and bring in a very controlled economy going forward. So this is one line of argument that you see coming from organizations like the American Liberty League, for example, which was a group of business leaders who got together in 1934 to start to kind of mount both legal challenges to the New Deal and also to campaign publicly against it. The other is a sense that it wasn't going to be effective, that the New Deal wasn't ending the Depression, that it was naive, ill thought out, badly planned. Instead of seeing it as this masterly power grab, it's seeing it as kind of incompetent, foolish, and ineffective.
Those arguments have an eerily familiar ring to them in the context of the Green New Deal. There was one commentator who did this broadside against the deal based on the fact that Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez is an unmarried, childless barmaid and therefore is no person to entrust with this kind of responsibility. But then, you know, in other commentary, there's also the subject of totalitarian-level federal overreach. You've written that the New Deal was, in its essence, an emergency rescue operation to save capitalism from itself. I think that was your phrase, which in hindsight makes perfect sense. But really, knowing what we know about American politics, is it any wonder that the capitalists didn't want the government to barge into its free markets and inject the public sector into private enterprise? Of course they said it was a path to totalitarianism.
I think it's actually just important to remember both how severe the crisis was in 1932 when Roosevelt was elected. Unemployment was almost at a quarter of the population, much higher in many cities. Thousands of banks were failing. It wasn't just that there was an ideological attack on structures of property or capitalism. There was actually a real question about what was going to happen to the economy and how it could recover. And I think this is part of why many business people were so anxious about the New Deal.
So not necessarily fear-mongering. It was actual fear.
I think it was actual fear. Roosevelt himself never had any interest in challenging basic elements of a capitalist economy. But he was willing, and the circumstances were such that it was possible to do things that actually did change the balance of power in economic life in pretty profound ways. And I think shouldn't be surprising that parts of the New Deal met with fierce resistance, so too parts of the Green New Deal are likely to meet with fierce resistance. And the question is whether there will be political movements, leaders, mobilizations that are capable of countering that.
No, I scarcely need to tell you this because this is like the whole Phillips Fine deal. But the history of federal regulation of business is the history of these sky is falling predictions about job loss and recession and so on. Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, auto safety, OSHA, Obamacare, minimum wage, you name it, all were going to tilt the playing field and ruin our economy. Did these arguments, which, by the way, as far as I can tell, have never been borne out right. by reality. Mm-hmm. Did they begin in the 30s, or was there a precedent for them even then?
No, arguments have been circulating around since the late 19th century. People like William Graham Sumner and Andrew Carnegie arguing that the efforts to use government will wind up hurting ordinary people rather than helping them inadvertently. And you should just let the market do its work. But I think they get a new charge in the 30s. And in a way, the 30s are the first time that there is someone in Washington who builds a political career himself out of responding to and inspiring this political impulse to find some way to even the economic playing field.
Let's look at one of the pieces of legislation just to get a notion of what specifically the criticisms were.
Mm-hmm.
One of the early targets was in 1933, the Securities Act, which tried to create some sort of protections for investors. What was the policy exactly, and what were the dire warnings that came from Wall Street?
The effort was to mandate that any company that was issuing public securities had to publish and make available a range of information to investors. This was happening in the wake of the stock market crash of 1929 and fraudulent reports that companies had been circulating about themselves. So it was basically trying to mandate that any company that was going to be selling stock had to release honest information about its financial situation. The next year saw the creation of the Securities and Exchange Commission, which was charged with regulating and guaranteeing this. And the response from Wall Street was outraged terror, a sense that this simple request for information was reaching into the boardroom in ways that were heavy-handed and controlling on the one hand, and then also that it was going to frighten investors away, and so it would actually be responsible for prolonging the depression. The law in 1934 wound up quelling a lot of this, partly because the first head of the SEC was Joseph Kennedy, who was viewed as one of the Wall Street community and not somebody who was going to be, you know, hostile force. So at that point, a lot of the resistance really died down.
How did Roosevelt and the Democrats answer the charges of creeping Stalinism and Jewish overlords and the rest?
Roosevelt himself was always very insistent that what he was doing was in the interests of all Americans, that it was not intended to subvert democratic institutions, but to preserve them, that he was just bringing forward the promise of the country into a new era. I mean, the New Deal actually also involved the active participation of many people across the country and kind of touched and transformed people's lives, either through direct relief from the state or through the employment that it offered or through the ways in which it transformed communities that saw new public works being built and the artistic creations that were funded by the federal government during the New Deal. All of these things actually gave people a sense of the New Deal being something that wasn't just imposed on them from outside, but actually something that they were helping to build. Also, the organization of unions during the New Deal was another way in which people actually actively had a sense of participating in building a new kind of social and economic order.
Kim, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kim Phillips-Fine is a historian at New York University and author of Invisible Hands, The Businessman's Crusade Against the New Deal.
Coming up, when it comes to climate change, research finds that Congress doesn't get what Gen Z wants, or what Gen X wants, or what the boomers want either.
This is On the Media.